days. Children and parents vary widely in terms of how quickly they respond to this approach. The first goal is to take the fuel out of the fire as quickly as possible by dramatically decreasing the use of Plan A and dramatically increasing the use of Plans B and C. This shift in the way parents respond to and communicate with their child should correspond with a decrease in the frequency, duration, and intensity of explosions. And, of course, an increase in the use of Plan B also means that numerous triggers, problems that have yet to be solved, are getting solved. Some families are able to achieve this in a few weeks. Some take several months, and others take longer still. Some children continue to have occasional, residual, unsafe episodes for a few months, but some episodes are often far less intense and fizzle out a lot faster. As you'll read in the next chapter, once this phase has been reached, the stage is set for more direct work on your child's pathways. Should I reward my child for doing Plan B? Fewer explosions and getting along better with you are usually reward enough. So, does using this approach mean that rewards and punishment are completely out of the picture? Not necessarily, but by now you should have a very realistic sense of what rewards and punishments can and can't help you achieve, and an awareness of the special care required when using consequences with an explosive child. The real question is this: will additional motivation enhance your child's performance at any point along the way? The answer, probably not. But let's think about it. The first thing you'd want to be convinced of is that your child actually needs additional motivation. Our philosophy that children do well if they can suggests that your child is already sufficiently motivated. Second, you'd want to be sure that motivational strategies are worth the potential price. Many an explosion has been precipitated by the delivery of a punishment or the loss of an anticipated reward. Engaging children in discussions about how they can make amends for an act committed in the midst of frustration can be far more productive than punishment. Such discussions should not take place during or immediately after explosions, but rather once rational thinking has been fully restored. Here's what such a discussion might sound like. Parent: Carlos, we need to talk a little about the table you broke yesterday. Child: I said I was sorry. Parent: I know, and it was very nice of you to say that, but I still feel very bad about the broken table, and we still need to figure out what you can do to help me feel better. Child: Like what? Parent: I don't know. Can you think of anything you could do that would make me feel better? Child: You could punish me. Parent: I don't know if punishing you would make me feel better, and it certainly hasn't kept you from breaking things. I was thinking there might be some things you could help me with around the house. Child: I could sweep the floors. Parent: That's an idea. That would be very helpful. Is that something you'd do to help me feel better? Child: Yes, or I could help you take out the trash. Parent: I think it would be most helpful for you to sweep the floors. That would make me feel a lot better. Maybe next time you get frustrated, you could let me help you instead of breaking the table. Child: I'll try. What about time out? Some children actually find time out to be a good place to calm down when they're frustrated, although this is the exception, since timeout is usually used as a punishment. More commonly, the explosions of many children are actually exacerbated, sometimes dramatically so. If someone makes any kind of physical contact with them when they're frustrated, so if timeout simply fuels your child's explosions, forget it. Even under optimal circumstances, timeout is typically not recommended for older children and adolescents. On the other hand, it can be productive to help parents and children agree to go their separate ways. with each going to different designated rooms of the house. When it becomes obvious that a discussion is going poorly or is not going to be resolved immediately, not all explosive children will follow through on this plan, but a surprising number will. The discussion resumes after everyone has calmed down and had a chance to think a little. But I still have the feeling that some of my child's behavior is planned and willful. How do I tell the difference? The last thing you'd want to try to do at times when your child is becoming frustrated is to quickly try to figure out whether his behavior is planned or unplanned. You don't have a whole lot of time to spare, and it isn't easy to tell. So there are essentially two possible mistakes you can make at such moments. The first is to think your child's behavior is unplanned and unintentional, when it really isn't. The second is thinking your child's behavior is planned and intentional, when it really isn't. If you have to make an error, make the first error. In other words, when in doubt, respond as if your child's behavior is unplanned and unintentional. The ramifications of the second error are much more serious. My child becomes frustrated about things that don't involve interactions with me or other people. He just gets really frustrated with something he's doing, like playing PlayStation, or sometimes he has a delayed response to a frustration that happened earlier in the day. What then? It's true, there are times when it seems as if there's nothing to work out because your child's frustration didn't involve you or another person. And there are instances in which a child's frustration at the moment is a delayed response to an earlier frustration, such as something that happened in school. But your role remains the same, to find out what's up and help solve the problem. Perhaps with emergency B today, but with proactive B tomorrow, if the problem was really quite predictable. Mother, standing on the front walk to the house. Charlotte, we're waiting for you to get in the car so we can go to the beach. Charlotte, standing in the front doorway.
I'm not going.
Mother, what? Charlotte, you love the beach. Charlotte, backing into the house.
I said I'm not going.
Mother, moving toward the front door and using plan A.
Charlotte, your brother and your father are already in the car. We're in a hurry, and I don't like going through this with you right now. Go get me my keys, and let's go.
Charlotte, slamming and locking the front door to the house.
Stay away from me! I'm not going!
Mother, still using plan A.
Charlotte, you unlock this door right now, turning to husband in car.
Honey, do you have the keys?
Husband, no. Why?
Mother, pulse pounding, turning back to the locked front door, still using plan A.
Charlotte, open the door! Damn it! This isn't funny!
No response from inside the house.
Father, arriving at front door.
What's going on?
Mother, through the gritted teeth.
Your daughter has informed me that she's not going to the beach and has locked us out of our house.
That actually looks like an example of how not to do it. Now, through the magic of book writing, let's do something that you don't have the luxury of doing in real life. Rewind the tape and try a different approach.
Charlotte, I'm not going.
Mother, empathy with a question mark.
You're not going?
Charlotte,
no, I'm not going.
Mother,
what's the matter, honey?
Charlotte, rubbing her eyes.
I just don't want to go.
Mother, squatting down to Charlotte's level. Is there something about going to the beach today that's bothering you?
You usually can't wait to go to the beach.
Charlotte,
it's too early to go to the beach.
Mother,
I don't know what you mean, that it's too early to go to the beach.
Charlotte,
we don't usually go to the beach until after church. We never go to the beach in the morning.
Mother, Refined empathy. It's bothering you that we don't usually go to the beach in the morning.
Charlotte, we never go to the beach in the morning. We can't go right now.
Mother, defining the problem.
I'm glad you told me what was the matter.
The thing is, we're all ready to go. But let's think about this a little. Maybe we can figure out what to do.
Much nicer.
My child has to have each solution spelled out in perfect detail. Is this normal? Many explosive kids don't handle ambiguity in their lives well, and this extends to their solutions to problems. So statements like, okay, we'll do that later, or we'll go there soon, or you can do that for a while, have the potential to feel their frustration, even in the context of Plan B.
Trent, sitting in the backyard of the family car.
I need something to eat.
Mother, in the role of genius and lucking out, temporarily. We'll stop for something very soon.
Trent.
Okay.
5 minutes of silence elapse.
Trent, with agitation.
I thought you said we were stopping to eat.
Mother,
I said we'd stop soon.
Trent, with significant greater agitation.
I can't wait. You said we were stopping.
Father, choosing Plan A over performing a rescue mission.
Your mother said we'd stop soon. Now put a lid on it.
Trent, very loudly, kicking the back of his father's seat.
You guys are such freaking liars. You say you'll do something, and then you don't.
Mother,
still no empathy.
Look, we'll stop for food as soon as we can.
Kaboom.
On a related topic, some kids don't adapt well when a solution doesn't go exactly as planned. Mike, a remarkable rigid 13-year-old, had agreed with his mother over when 12 noon on Saturday and how, with her help, he'd clean his room. Mike was actually eager to get his room straightened up, but he lacked the organizational skills to do it on his own. Unfortunately, the mother was delayed by another commitment and wasn't around at 12 noon to help Mike clean up his room. This change in plan proved to be a major obstacle for Mike. When the mother arrived home at 1:30 p.m. and suggested that they begin cleaning the room, Mike was very agitated. At 1:31, the mother insisted that they clean the room. Mike's agitation increased. The mother insisted further. At 1:32, Mike exploded. What Mike needed was a complete reconfiguring of the original solution. He was just that rigid. Many of the examples I've read so far relate to younger children. My explosive child is 15. Any special suggestions? Believe it or not, your child's chronological age is not the key issue. His developmental age, in the domains of flexibility and frustration tolerance, is the key issue. So while the language we'd use would probably be more sophisticated for a 15-year-old than for a 4-year-old, the emphasis on identifying pathways and triggers would be exactly the same. Kids respond to being understood and to a collaborative approach regardless of age. My explosive child has siblings who are non-explosive and respond to Plan A. Am I supposed to have two different types of discipline going on in my household at the same time? Kids who respond to Plan A also tend to respond to Plan B. So if you want to be consistent, do Plan B with your non-explosive kids, too. But here's another angle. There isn't a household in the world where all the children are treated exactly the same. In all households, one child is getting something another isn't getting. Fair does not mean equal. Your non-explosive children want your explosive child to stop exploding more than they want everyone to be treated exactly the same. More on siblings, though, in Chapter 9. How come my child explodes at home, but not at school? Doesn't that prove he can hold it together when he feels like it? Well, more likely it proves something we already knew, that he explodes only under certain conditions. Schools have a few advantages over homes. The schedule is more predictable. That's helpful for some explosive kids. There's less unstructured time
That's helpful for some explosive kids. And your child's medicine, especially if it's a stimulant, is in full effect during school hours. But the main advantage schools have is the embarrassment factor. Your child is keeping himself very tightly wrapped at school because he doesn't want to embarrass himself. Then he gets home and unravels because he's put so much energy into staying tightly wrapped at school. See, he can't keep himself tightly wrapped 24 hours a day. Homes aren't as structured and predictable as most schools, and homes don't have the embarrassment factor. My child is exploding at school, and I don't think the teachers have heard of this model. Advice? Sounds like your child is blowing through the embarrassment factor. Schools, not all but most, tend to be bastions of Plan A. You'll have to make sure they get exposed to this model. More in Chapter 11. There are many problems that haven't been mentioned yet, like lying, stealing, drug use, sex. How would those problems be handled using Plan B? The steps are the same, and the empathy step may be the hardest. Just remember, some difficult issues require more than one Plan B conversation. Sometimes the solution that ends up solving the problem durably isn't arrived at until after a few solutions to the problem have been tried. But here's what a proactive Plan B conversation might look like on the lying issue. Adult empathy. I've noticed that sometimes it's hard for you to tell me the truth about some things. Child. Like what? Adult. Well, the other day, I asked you if your homework was done, and you told me it was, so I let you keep playing your video game. But I got a note from Mrs. Nixon today that your homework actually wasn't done. Child, she's lying. Adult, empathy. She could be lying, I guess, but I've noticed that you were having trouble telling the truth about some other things that had nothing to do with Mrs. Nixon. Child, what else? Adult, when I called home from my meeting last week, I asked you if you had mowed the lawn, and you told me you had, and then I got home and the lawn wasn't mowed. Remember?
Well, I meant to mow the lawn before you got home, but I didn't get to it.
Adult. Empathy, then defining the problem. I understand how that could happen. The thing is, when you lie to me about those things, it makes me feel like I can't trust you on other things. Child. Okay, I won't lie anymore. Adult. Clarifying the problem. That would be wonderful. But I think I'd like to feel a little more confident about that if I understood why you were having trouble telling me the truth in the first place. Child, I don't want you to get mad at me and punish me. Adult, empathy. Ah, you don't want me to get mad and punish you. I can understand that. I guess I can get pretty mad about things, can't I? Child,
yep.
Adult, redefining the problem, then invitation. Okay, so you sometimes have trouble telling me the truth because you don't want me to get mad and punish you. And I want to feel like I can trust you to tell the truth. Let's think about what we can do about that. You have any ideas? Child, you could promise not to get mad and punish me. Adult, I could promise that. I'm trying very hard not to punish you anymore. Because it doesn't seem to be helping, have you noticed? Child,
sorta.
Adult, but I don't know if I can promise that I'll never get mad at you again. I might slip sometimes. I can promise to try very hard not to get mad at you. Child,
I could promise to try very hard not to lie to you.
Adult, so we both have something to work on, don't we?
Child,
yep. Adult, what should we do if I slip up and get mad?
Child, I could remind you of your promise.
Adult, that would be very helpful. What should I do if you slip up and tell me a lie?
Child, you could remind me of my promise.
Adult, I think we've got a plan. Let's see how it works. If it doesn't work too well, we'll talk again and see if we can figure out what to do instead.
Child,
okay. What if you thought that your adolescent daughter was having unprotected sex with her boyfriend, and you had some concerns about that? With plan A, you're starting the conversation by saying you must not have sex with your boyfriend, in which case the conversation wouldn't take place because you ended the discussion before it even got started. With plan C, you're not having the conversation because you're not raising the topic. And here's what it looks like with plan B. Parent, can we talk about something? Daughter, like what? Parent, like you and Kenny. Daughter, oh no, here we go again. Parent, no wait, I just want to talk. I'm not going to lecture you. Daughter, yeah, right. Parent, look, I know you have very strong feelings for Kenny, and you want to show him how you feel. Daughter, I don't want to talk about this with you. Parent, I know. This isn't exactly a walk in the park for me either, but I'm concerned about you. Daughter, don't be. I'm fine. Parent, I can't help it. Mothers worry about their daughters. Daughter, thank you for worrying about me. This is none of your business. Parent, can you just bear with me for 1 second? Even if it's none of my business. Daughter, fine, talk fast. Parent, maybe we should find a better time to talk about it. Daughter, there is no good time to talk about this. Talk, before I change my mind. Parent, okay, I know you have strong feelings for Kenny, and you want to show him how you feel. Daughter, you're repeating yourself. Parent, yes, I am. I'm worried that you're going to get pregnant. Daughter, oh my God. I cannot believe we're talking about this. This is so embarrassing. I'm not going to get pregnant. Parent, what's keeping you from getting pregnant? Daughter, this is too embarrassing. Parent, so reassure me a little so we can stop talking about it. Daughter, Kenny uses condoms. I can't believe this. Parent, always? Every time? Daughter, almost every time. Are we done? Parent, almost. Almost every time means you could still get pregnant. Daughter, I'm not going to get pregnant. Parent, I appreciate your confidence about that. I'm just wondering how we can make me more confident about that. Daughter, it's not my job to make you more confident about that. Parent, no, I guess it's not, but I do worry, and I like to not worry. Daughter, fine, stop worrying. Parent, I wish it was that easy. Look, as long as we're on the topic, can we talk about one more thing? Daughter, this conversation is taking too long already. Parent, should we talk about it another time? Daughter, no, let's get this over with. Parent, you don't think you're too young. Are you sure you can handle all the feelings that go along with it? What about your reputation? Daughter, look, Mom, I've been messing around with Kenny for longer than you know. I'm handling it. I love him. He loves me. My reputation is fine. Parent, okay. Look, I just wanted to talk about those things. To make sure you were thinking about them. I didn't have sex with anyone when I was 15, and I didn't think my daughter would either. Daughter, sorry to disappoint you, but I'm really okay. It's nice of you to care, sort of. Parent, well, I'm not completely convinced that you're okay, but I'll leave it alone for now. But if you're going to be doing it, and there's no way I can't stop you, I guess, then can we at least make sure you're using a form of contraception that's a little more reliable? I'm too tired to do this. I'm sick of my child, and I don't have the energy to do all the talking and working things out that you've described. Any advice? Living with an explosive child requires a lot of energy, which means we've got to find ways to get you your energy back. I've seen the approach described in this book accomplish just that. As parents begin to understand their child's difficulties and respond in a more productive fashion, then the child begins to explode less. Then the parent starts to feel a greater sense of empowerment. As things continue to go well, the parent begins to feel more energized and optimistic. But it's also the case that some parents need to focus on themselves, sometimes with a therapist, find ways to spend time away from the child and recharge, and find ways to focus on other aspects of life besides the child. Mental health clinicians, support groups, social service agencies, spouses, relatives, and friends can sometimes be of help. Chapter 8. Teach Your Children Well. We've covered a fair amount of ground already. At this point, I hope you have a sense of your child's pathways, skills that need to be taught, and have identified various triggers that routinely precipitate explosive outbursts, problems that need to be solved. Perhaps you've reduced some of the tension in your household by eliminating some unnecessary or unrealistic expectations with Plan C. And perhaps you've reduced the likelihood of explosions even further by collaboratively solving some of the problems that were precipitating those explosions with Plan B. Bear in mind that you may feel as if you're slogging through mud in your first attempts at Plan B. It can take a while to get into a Plan B rhythm. However, as you've read, it's also the case that there are some specific skills that are necessary for a child to participate in Plan B discussions. As you'll see, these skills were already described when the pathways were reviewed in Chapter 3. Now we need to put some thought into how these skills can be taught. We'll cover that topic next. And while we're at it, we should be sure to touch upon other skills reviewed in Chapter 3, just to make sure we've got all our bases covered. Skills needed to participate in Plan B. There are three basic skills necessary for your child to participate in Plan B discussions. First, he must be able to identify and articulate his concerns. Otherwise, we won't be able to get two concerns onto the table, and the Plan B ship won't leave port. Second, he needs to be able to consider a range of possible solutions, or the Plan B ship will run aground. Finally, he needs to be able to reflect on the feasibility and likely outcomes of solutions and the degree to which they are mutually satisfactory. Otherwise, the Plan B ship will chug in random directions, perhaps never arriving at a desired port. If your child is lacking these skills, you've got more work to do. Let's take them one at a time. Identifying and articulating concerns. When you're trying to get your child's concerns on the table and you ask him, "What's up?" there's a pretty good chance his response will be, "I don't know." Does that mean Plan B is done for? No. But it does mean you have a skill to teach. Some kids truly don't know what their concern is. Others don't have the language skills to articulate their concern. Luckily, because explosions are highly predictable, once again, your child is often exploding over many of the same problems or frustrations. We can probably take very educated guesses as to what your child is frustrated about. Here's what a proactive Plan B discussion would sound like if you were trying to help your child identify his concern. Parent, empathy. I've noticed you don't want to take your medicine anymore. Child, right? Parent, what's up? Child, don't know. Parent, you don't know why you don't want to take your medicine anymore? Child, no, I just don't want to. Parent, well, I can think of a few reasons why someone wouldn't want to take their medicine. Should I guess? Then we can try to solve the problem. Child, okay. Parent, I've noticed that it seems to make you tired sometimes. Is that it? Child, well, it does make me a little tired, but I don't mind that so much. Parent, okay, I guess that's not it. Is it that you're having trouble swallowing the pill? I've noticed that you don't seem to have an easy time with that. Child, how could you tell? Parent, because it looks like you're about to choke before you finally swallow the pill.
Child, that's it.
Parent,
that's it. You're having trouble swallowing the pill. That's why you don't want to take it.
Child,
yes.
Now that the child's concern has been identified and is on the table, the Plan B discussion can continue with the define the problem and invitation steps, as described in Chapter 6. Let's say that sensory hypersensitivities are a common trigger for your child. But while he's aware that, for example, tags in his clothing are bothersome, he's having difficulty verbalizing that concern. It would make sense to help your child articulate his concern. Perhaps, the label is bothering me, in order to circumvent the swearing, screaming, and thrashing about that normally accompanies this frustration. Here's how that might sound. I've noticed that the labels in your clothing bug you a lot.
Child.
Yeah.
Parent.
And I've noticed that it's not so easy for you to say that the labels are bugging you.
Child.
It's not?
Parent.
Well, when the labels bother you, sometimes you scream or say some words that aren't very nice.
Child.
Oh, yeah.
Parent.
So I was thinking that maybe we could come up with a way for you to say that the labels are bugging you without you saying words that aren't very nice. Can you think of any ideas for what you could say?
Of course, since children do well if they can, we'd have to assume that if the child already knew more appropriate words, he'd already be using them. So be prepared to offer a few suggestions.
Child.
No.
Parent. I have an idea.
Would you like to hear it?
Child.
Okay.
Parent.
How about the label's bothering me?
Child.
Okay.
Parent.
Do you think you might be able to say that when the label's bothering you instead of some of the things you usually say?
Child.
I think so.
Parent.
If you forget, how about I remind you?
Incidentally, by merely raising the issue, you've let the child know that you don't think his choice of words is appropriate. Of course, he probably knew that already.
Naturally, your child's new vocabulary won't be ingrained in one day. He'll almost certainly need some in-the-moment reminders.
Child, I hate this shirt. It sucks.
Parent,
uh-oh,
looks like the label is bugging you.
Note that the parent isn't reminding by saying, "Don't forget what we agreed on yesterday," or "You can't talk to me that way," because these aren't specific enough reminders of the new vocabulary.
Of course, the label is bothering me is a highly specific phrase. It applies only to situations in which labels are bothersome. So it's often productive to teach a more general set of phrases that can be applied across many different situations. We adults greatly overestimate our own vocabularies when it comes to articulating frustrations. The truth is, we're usually relying on just a few reliable expressions. Phrases you might want to consider teaching your child include, "Give me a minute." "I can't talk about that right now." "I need help." "I don't feel right." "This isn't going the way I thought it would." And, "I don't know what to do." Teaching these phrases looks exactly the same as the labels phrase above, and it's a sure bet some gentle reminding will be necessary on these phrases as well.
Mother. Jackson, how was your day at school?
Jackson. Don't ask me that question. Shut up.
Mother.
Sounds like you can't talk about that right now.
Jackson.
I can't talk about that right now.
Mother.
No problem. Maybe you'll be able to talk about it later.
How quickly will your child reliably use this new vocabulary?
Hard to say. But if this is the skill your child is lacking, this is the way to teach it, considering a range of possible solutions. As you know, the third step of Plan B is the invitation. This is the step where you and your child are brainstorming potential solutions to the problem, defined by the two concerns that were put on the table in the first two steps. As you read in Chapter 6,
If your child isn't able to think of any solutions, that's a clear sign that he's, well, having trouble thinking of solutions. Of course, it could be a sign that you've never given him the chance to think of solutions. So it's possible that your child's skills in this area are better than you think. If his solution-generating skills aren't so hot, it's possible that they will improve simply by hearing you propose potential solutions numerous times. But some kids truly don't have the slightest idea where to start when it comes to thinking of solutions. So let's give them an idea of where to start. Hard to believe, but it turns out that the vast majority of solutions to problems encountered by human beings fall into one of three general categories. 1. Ask for help. 2. Meet halfway, give a little. And 3. Do it a different way. These categories can be very helpful to children whose pathways are in the language processing domain, for they simplify the language of problem solving and can be taught through pictures if words are too cumbersome. The categories can also be helpful to children who become easily overwhelmed by the universe of potential solutions. First, you'll want to introduce the categories to your child at an opportune moment. Then, when you're trying to generate solutions using Plan B, use the categories as the framework for considering solutions. Parent, I've noticed that you haven't wanted to go to gymnastics lately. What's up? Child, I don't like my coach. Adult, you don't like your new coach. You mean Jenny? How come? Child, it's boring. All she has us do is stretch. That's boring. Adult, okay. Let me make sure I've got this straight. You haven't wanted to go to gymnastics lately because it's boring. Just a bunch of stretching. Child, right. Adult, I can understand that. The thing is, you usually really like gymnastics and you're really good at it. So I'd hate to see you give it up. Child, I don't care. Adult, really? You sure you don't care? Child, not if it's just going to be a bunch of stretching. Adult, well, I wonder if there's a way to solve this problem so you're doing more of the things you like in gymnastics. Child, Ginny's not going to change the way she does her class. Adult, you might be right about that, but let's think about this. I don't know if asking for help will solve this problem. And I can't think of how we would meet halfway or give a little on this one. Especially if you think Ginny isn't going to change the way she does her class. I'm thinking this is one where we'd try to do it a different way. What do you think? Child, I don't know what a different way would be. Adult, well, Ginny's not the only one who teaches that level. The main reason we picked Ginny's class is because the other class that's your level is the same time as your ice skating lesson. But I bet we could change ice skating to a different time. Then you could be in the other class. What do you think? Naturally, this Plan B discussion would continue until a realistic, doable, and mutually satisfactory solution has been agreed upon. Not only would the problem get solved, Plan B would have been done in a way that set the stage, over time, for the child to begin using the categories as a framework for generating solutions. This expectation is that eventually the child would no longer need a surrogate frontal lobe to steer her through the process, reflect on the likely outcomes of solutions and the degree to which they are feasible and mutually satisfactory. One of the reasons parents lose faith in Plan B, at least initially, is that the child has failed to follow through on an agreed-upon solution. As you know, this is usually the sign of an unrealistic solution. One of the two parties involved wasn't actually capable of delivering on what they'd agreed to, or a solution that failed to adequately address the child's concern. Remember, Plan B isn't an exercise in wishful thinking. It's the hard work of collaborating on mutually satisfactory and doable solutions. It turns out that a lot of children, perhaps especially those whose difficulties involve the executive skills pathway, have difficulty thinking about the likely outcomes of solutions they consider. Others, often those whose difficulties involve the cognitive flexibility skills and social skills pathways, have difficulty thinking about whether the solutions under consideration are truly realistic and address both concerns. The first issue can be addressed by having the surrogate frontal lobe anticipate and describe the likely outcomes of the solutions that have been generated. Well, here's what I think will happen if we choose that solution, and here's what I think it will look like if we choose the second option. Which of those outcomes do you think would work the best? If a child is having difficulty thinking about whether solutions address both concerns, adults can respond as follows.
Miguel, I know that solution would make you happy,
but it wouldn't make me very happy. Let's try to think of a solution that would make both of us happy.
If the child can't think of a mutually satisfactory solution,
the surrogate frontal lobe is there to help. After multiple repetitions, the child should be better able to independently generate solutions that are mutually satisfactory. Training other skills with Plan B, language processing skills. Some of the skills discussed above can emanate from difficulties in language processing, but as you read in Chapter 3, there are a few other language processing skills worth thinking about as they relate to your child's ability to deal effectively with frustration. Some children, for example, have trouble expressing the fact that they're frustrated. In other words, they lack a basic vocabulary of feeling words, so they don't have the words to tell you that they're frustrated. Instead, they swear or hit or destroy things. So, if a child is lacking a basic vocabulary of feeling words, there's only one thing to do. Teach him a basic vocabulary of feeling words, starting with happy, sad, and, of course, frustrated. Why only three words? Because, regardless of a person's age, if you're overambitious in teaching new skills, you won't teach any skills at all. And because those three feelings cover about 80% of human emotions anyway. Once a child becomes comfortable with and begins using this rudimentary vocabulary, more sophisticated feeling words, despondent, dysphoric, disenfranchised, discombobulated, can be added to a child's repertoire. For some kids, even starting with the word frustrated is too advanced. Some actually can't say the word, in which case angry or mad will suffice. For some, saying any words is too frustrating, in which case it's often useful to have the child point to a picture of a frustrated face or rank their level of frustration with numbers, a 0 to 5 ranking system, in which 0 denotes not frustrated at all, and 5 denotes really, really frustrated. Or colors, for example, green denotes not frustrated at all. Yellow signifies starting to get frustrated, and red denotes really, really frustrated. Of course, it's important for the adults to use the same terminology as the child and to give the child opportunities for using the language at times other than when he's most frustrated. For example, Helen, a child you read about in Chapter 4, learned and practiced her rudimentary vocabulary by discussing the past day's events with her parents at bedtime. The parents would ask her what happened during the day that made her happy, whether anything made her sad, and whether anything caused her to feel frustrated. If Helen couldn't remember specific events that fit one of these three categories, her parents would suggest some possibilities. If Helen had difficulty labeling the emotions that were associated with a particular event, her parents would help her. The parents made sure Helen's teacher was also aware of her new vocabulary so that Helen didn't become confused by different terminology. When Helen became frustrated and expressed her frustration inappropriately, "No, I can't do that right now. Leave me alone. Screw you." Or worse, her parents and teacher would calmly remind her of her new vocabulary. "Boy, you sure sound frustrated." Over the course of several months, Helen began to express her emotions in a much more appropriate manner, across an increased number and range of situations, and her vocabulary of emotions slowly became broader and more sophisticated, and eventually included such terms as confused, disappointed, excited, bored, and annoyed. Don't forget, just as a child with a reading disability won't begin reading overnight, a child, explosive or not, who has difficulty recognizing, expressing, or describing frustration, won't begin using his new vocabulary overnight. There's no quick fix. But this isn't rocket science, either. The skills we're teaching are fairly basic. It's just that consequences don't teach them. So if swearing is usually a sign that a child doesn't currently have the linguistic skills to express frustration adaptively, then responding to swearing with, "I refuse to be spoken to like that," or "Go to your room and come back when you're ready to talk to me the right way," wouldn't get the job done unless your child actually lacked the knowledge that you didn't want to be spoken to that way, or wasn't motivated to speak to you the right way. Mother, we had a bad incident this week, and I'm not sure I handled it well. Therapist, tell me. Mother, well, I was making pancakes for breakfast. Derek came into the kitchen and said he didn't want pancakes. I told him that's what was on the menu. Therapist, sorry to interrupt, but did you mean to be handling eating pancakes with plan A? Mother, smiling, no. Therapist, just curious. Go on. Mother, so then he called me a name and ran out the kitchen. I ran after him and told him he was grounded for a week for calling me a name. He told me to get away from him. I insisted on an immediate apology. He went ballistic for the next half hour. Therapist, it sounds extremely unpleasant. You mentioned that you wished you'd handled things differently. Mother, first off, I shouldn't have been doing plan A on the pancakes.
I could have helped him find something else to eat.
Therapist, true. You could have done that with plan B or C. Anything else? Mother, I guess I shouldn't get so upset when he swears at me. Therapist, it's very hard not to get upset when your son calls you a name. But you've been punishing him for calling you names for a very long time, and he still calls you a name every time he gets frustrated. So I don't think he needs any more lessons on the importance of not swearing or any more motivation not to swear. At the moment, it seems pretty clear that Derek isn't very good at expressing his frustration without swearing, so he needs your help. Mother, so what should I have said? Therapist, did you have a concern to put on the table besides the swearing, I mean? Mother, well, I wasn't dying to make him something else, you know. We were in a bit of a rush. But it's not like he would have wanted me to make him an omelet. No, I guess I really didn't have a concern. Therapist, then you'd have handled it with plan C, in which case you could have said, I think what you're saying is that you'd like something else to eat besides pancakes. What would you like? Mother, so I blew it, right? Therapist, no, you didn't blow it. This is really hard. Your understandable knee-jerk instinct is to punish your kid when he swears at you. And I'm asking you to do something different, because punishing him isn't working. It's hard to do. Mother, yes, it is. How will he learn that swearing's not okay? Therapist, first of all, I think he knows swearing's not okay. He swears under only one condition: when he's frustrated. If he thought swearing was okay, he'd be swearing at other times. But even if he did think swearing was okay, you're still letting him know it's not by giving him different words to use. I think it's worth pointing out that Derek did something very adaptive in the incident you described. Mother, he did? What? Therapist, instead of going toe-to-toe with you in the kitchen, he detached himself from the situation. In other words, he left. He went into the other room. That's something he would never have done before, but you followed him. Mother,
I did, didn't I? Therapist.
So we have some more work to do.
But we're getting there. For children with linguistic impairments, language therapists can also be very helpful at facilitating many of the pragmatic skills discussed in this and the preceding chapter. Specifically, helping children label their emotions, identify and articulate their frustrations, and think through solutions. Executive skills. Let's think back on some of the executive skills reviewed in Chapter 3. Organization and planning, shifting cognitive set, and separation of effect. How does Plan B address difficulties a child might be having in these domains? Well, Plan B provides your child with an organized, structured, predictable framework for solving problems and helps him consider a range of possible solutions, besides the first thing that pops into his head, and anticipate the likely outcomes of alternative solutions. Proactive B can help you and your child solve the predictable problems that arise with respect to the shifts or transitions that are required throughout the day in your household. For example, from sleeping to waking, getting dressed to eating breakfast to catching the bus, school to home, free time to homework, and TV time to dinner or bedtime, and of all the things Plan B does well, helping your child suspend his emotional response to a problem so that he can stay calm enough to think. Separation of effect would be high on the list. Many children who have difficulties with executive skills are also hyperactive and/or inattentive, and, as described in Chapter 10, these children may also be helped by medication. Emotion regulation skills. As you read in Chapter 3, kids who have difficulties regulating their emotions are often more irritable or anxious than other kids, and as you also read, irritability and anxiety can make it hard for any of us to think clearly under duress. There is a very strong tendency, especially in the United States, to use medication to reduce children's irritability and anxiety, and for some children, medication is truly indispensable. But one reason such medications are overused is that a lot of prescribers don't know about the pathways and haven't really gotten to the bottom of a child's irritability or anxiety. Can Plan B reduce a child's anxiety and irritability? Absolutely. By helping parent and child solve the problems that are contributing to the irritability and anxiety in the first place. In other words, many children's irritability and anxiety can be traced back to chronic problems that have perpetually gone unsolved. Might the child be less anxious if we finally found a way to solve the problem of the monster under the bed? Might the child's anxiety be reduced and mood be enhanced if the problem of being bullied at school was finally durably solved? If the problem of an unrecognized learning disability that has been adversely affecting his academic performance was finally durably solved? If his father's alcoholism was finally acknowledged and addressed, medicine doesn't solve these problems, and neither do consequences. Only solving problems solves problems. Cognitive flexibility skills. As you may recall, children whose difficulties stem from the cognitive flexibility pathway typically approach the world in a very black and white, literal, rigid manner. They have difficulties with grayer aspects of living, such as problem solving, social interactions, and unpredictable circumstances. In different ways, each of these three steps of Plan B can be extremely useful in helping these children handle demands for flexibility and frustration tolerance more adaptively. The first step, empathy reassurance, is crucial for such children, since they often overreact when faced with the realization